I was quite pleased when I was at the COP22 in Marrakesh to find that there was a steadiness despite the election results in the United States. People were alarmed to some extent, but the feeling was, because now we're talking implementation, it doesn't matter quite so much who is in charge at the federal level, if I could put it that way. Yes, it's not good news that somebody's put into the Environmental Protection Agency, who's known to be a climate denier and known to be close to the oil and gas industry, etc. It's not good that there's a sort of threat to deregulate, etc. But actually, what will matter in the United States is what matters is what's happening in cities and states of the United States in implementing. And for example, I was in Chicago recently. I was actually honored by the City Council of Chicago. And before going there, I did my homework. And Chicago is one of the leading cities of this network of cities on climate called C40 cities. There are far more than 40 now, but it started as 40 cities. And they want to give a leadership role on renewable energy, energy efficiency, and they know that's in their economic interest. So they're not going to change. And nor is New York, nor is the whole of California. They're going to go rapidly where their economic interest is.
So what kind of things are they doing already? What are you witnessing in terms of change?
Very sort of strict about energy efficiency and increasingly seeking to use renewable energy. And I'm told that Texas has moved more to renewable energy than oil in the last few years. Texas. Which is known for its oil. That is happening, and I think it's very interesting how rapidly it can happen once it's seen to be in the economic interest, once the opportunities are in that direction. And it's happening worldwide. I mean, China, after all, is now the leader on renewable energy, on wind and solar.
You talked about implementation in the US. You talked about economic interest. But it depends, doesn't it, on whose economic interest? The new administration in America has picked someone for the environmental agency who represents oil and gas interests. You do need, don't you, a federal government that's going to hold to that idea of cutting emissions?
Obviously, that is desirable, and I would even say necessary, that if the United States reneges on its Paris commitments and doesn't cut its emissions at least as much as Obama had committed to, which is still not enough, then the United States will become a rogue state in the world because every other country is going to be moving in that direction. Already, in a sense, China is becoming more of a leader on climate in a perceived sense than the United States. Is that where the people of the United States want to go? I doubt it.
A rogue state in the world, that's pretty strong language. I mean,
It is strong language because it has to be, because the United States has a historic responsibility as a major emitter because they built their economy on fossil fuel and they're still the second biggest emitter. So, you know, they have to take their responsibilities or be rightly criticized for not doing so.
What about individuals? Because for a lot of people, this idea of how do you cut emissions and how do you actually make a difference feels like such a big and difficult topic, something you just don't have time for in your day-to-day life. So what would your message be to people like that?
I think that is more and more what we need to be thinking about. This is too important to be left to governments or, for that matter, the United Nations. It's actually a matter for every family and every household because it's about the future of the children and grandchildren in every family. We do what Wangari Maathai urged us to do years ago in her capacity, getting the Nobel Peace Prize for what she was doing in Kenya in planting trees, etc. But she said we must reduce, reuse, recycle. Every family can do that.
So, Mary Robinson, you are optimistic, despite all of the fears, all of the worries, that the world is not going to implement these changes fast enough.
No, I'm not optimistic. I've learned a very important lesson from my dear friend, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. We were on a panel together in New York a few years ago in front of young people on social media, and Archbishop Tutu gets very excited in front of young people. And there was an American journalist moderating the two of us. And she turned to him sharply and said, Archbishop Tutu, why are you such an optimist? And he looked at her and he said, oh, no, dearie, I'm not an optimist. I'm a prisoner of hope. And that is a profoundly important way of characterizing where I am. I could describe the very difficult place we're in. We face an existential threat, a threat to the social cohesion of the world in 2050, say, when my five grandchildren will be in their 40s and they'll share the world with 9 billion others. And I could paint a very grim picture of how that world will feed itself, how it will have enough water, how it will have social cohesion. But actually, I prefer to see what we can do and must do in the next short period, window of opportunity we have to move more rapidly to the carbon neutral world. So that's the prisoner of hope. Hope generates an energy to change things. And that's what's important. But I am not optimistic. I'm very fearful of the forces of populism, the divides that I see in our world, when what we need is global solidarity.